Thank you. I'm going to call the tax committee to order, and we're going to start with Representative Bunn. Even though Representative Bunn, we do not yet have a quorum, we are short two people. We've had lots of members come and check in. When two more people walk in, we can formally move your bill. We can't do that yet. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have had Representative Broad go first. Is that okay? I thought you were... Oh, you know what? Representative Bond, can you just hang on? I didn't realize Representative Broad was ahead of you on the agenda, and she does have a testifier. So if we could do that, unless, you know, I apologize. That's my fault. Representative Broad, and for your testifier line to join us, we're probably not going to be able to move this bill for a little bit, but we're going to hear the testimony, and Representative Broad will make sure the bill is formally moved. So, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for accommodating us. I just wanted to make note for the record that Mr. Davis has actually been here since about 2:15, and so he's been very patient through the what I told him the fluid session is. He's been great in sitting around today because it's that important of a bill for him. So, Madam Chair, rather than you guys listening to me, what I'd like to do is just hand discussion over to Mr. Davis, and this is actually a rather simple bill to fix the situation in Washington Township in Lesueur County, and I do have an amendment that's being passed out, and obviously we'll move when the bill is moved, that will define the situation a little bit tighter so that it only will deal with this specific situation rather than changing the law on a statewide basis. But I think this one just makes sense. It's a very, very specific change that we're trying to make for a specific situation. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to have Mr. Davis present the rationale for why we're here.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Davis, and we apologize for the way this place worked.
That's fine. I know how government works.
So we're sorry you were sitting, and we really appreciate you being here very sincerely. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greg Davis. I'm a supervisor in Washington Township in Lesueur County. We were approached by a group of landowners in the Linder Bay sub-district about 10 years ago on Lake Washington, and they needed to update their septic system. They had first approached the city of Mankato because they thought maybe Mankato would come and put a sewer system around Lake Washington. Mankato said at that time they had no plans to do so. So they went ahead and created a subordinate service district with the cooperation of Washington Township. They, of course, were assessed for the cost of this, plus they had to purchase a couple of acres of land for a drain field. After they installed this system, about 5 years later, the city of Mankato changed their mind, did put a sewer system around the Lake Washington, so this subordinate service district cluster septic system was no longer needed. So they have now abandoned that system. They do still, however, have the 2 acres of land. It's in an area that could be sold as developmental land. They would like to have that land sold and have the proceeds from that land returned to those 15 lot owners, which we as a town board agree is only fair. But the law does not provide for that, and that's why we're here to change that.
Interesting. The law does not provide for that.
Now, we had our attorney look into it. He checked with the Minnesota Association of Township Officers. He also sought an opinion of the Attorney General, and there just was no precedent or there was no language in the law to return any proceeds if a subordinate service district is disbanded, to return that to the lot owners or landowners.
Huh.
So they all suggested this is probably the only route we could go is to have some legislation passed to change that.
Interesting.
And Madam Chair, I do have, and I certainly will be happy to provide to you for supportive documentation, I have the Attorney General's opinion that says Chapter 6, 365A does not make any special provisions for the disposition of property acquired or used by a town in connection with providing services within a subordinate service district. So, you know, this is a pretty simple fix that we, I think, have before us. And I really hope, Madam Chair, and I've talked to you about this before, and I'll put it on the record and ask you again. It just seems to me that this is a very specific situation that we're trying to fix, and I don't see it as a significant tax issue. It's more of a procedural issue for how towns deal with these funds. And so my hope, Madam Chair, is that as we discuss this a little bit further, that we could send this bill out alone. I don't see that this bill would be an attractive bill to be a vehicle for any other tax provisions, and I hope that we can get this provision passed. Again, this is a pretty simple fix. The Attorney General has suggested that we need to get this done. It certainly would help this, the landowners in this area as well as the township as well, kind of clarify a situation that I think boggles most people's minds.
Thank you, Representative Broad. And Representative Broad, did you want to move your bill on your amendment? No, as well.
Please, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if the amendment has been handed out.
Yes, you got it.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 2988.
Okay, so Representative Broad moves House File 2988, and then we have the DE1, Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment, which will just clarify that it's a couple things. It clarifies some language that the Senate had put on the bill on the Senate side, and then also will more define the bill to relate specifically to Washington Township.
Okay, thank you. Is there discussion to the DE1 amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposing, nay. The amendment is adopted. Questions for Ms. Davis or Representative Broad? Well, if not, Mr. Davis, I apologize you had to sit this long. I guess Representative Earhart does have a question. This is an interesting problem you have, and I empathize with your need to deal with this. And Representative Broad is right. She did ask for this bill to travel alone, as many of you have asked for your bills to travel alone. And I know Representative Broad has good intentions. I have to say I kind of worry about anything the Senate would view as a vehicle, and all I have to do is read all those great words in the DE1 amendment and have a little concern. But I do want that noted. Representative Broad has worked very hard off record all year, Mr. Davis, to try to convince me that this bill should be passed immediately and urgently and not part of a larger packet, and I understand the concern there. Representative Earhart, do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Rod, how do you determine if a bill is an attractive bill for other amendments and other bills?
Madam Chair and Representative Earhart, I always was told that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And I certainly don't think that anything should be added to this bill. I think this one's really simple. This one just fixes a specific situation. And I know also on the Senate side that Senator Sharon would be more than happy to see this bill come forward individually as well. She has an interest in the bill. And I know that on our side of the aisle, I certainly can say that our guys wouldn't add anything to it. And I'm sure, Madam Chair, the mainness is something that is also in the eye of the beholder, and I'm certainly sure that you wouldn't allow anything onto it either.
Yeah, sure. I think because it is a simple bill, it makes it extremely attractive. It doesn't have a lot of clutter.
Well, Representative Earhart, Representative Steele isn't here, but he might have a thought about his simple bill that became the fourth. The income tax increase last year, they carried the omnibus tax bill. But I do, in all seriousness, Mr. Davis, Representative Broad, will be vigilant in continuing to try to convince us that this should be all on its own. But we have the Senate to deal with, so I won't make that commitment here today. But I do appreciate you being here. And are there further questions for Representative Broad or Mr. Davis? If not, thank you again for being here. Thank you, Representative Broad, and we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion and honor the tax bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, Representative Bunn, I apologize again for the confusion there. And let's see. Who would like to move? Who's a research activity credit person? Is Representative Dabney? How about you? Representative Solberg wants to move. Representative Solberg will move House File 3704. Welcome, Representative Bunn. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I come before you today as someone who serves on the Bioscience and Emerging Technology Committee, who is interested generally in business climate in our state for both large and small firms, and who is interested in how to grow jobs and attract jobs in Minnesota, grow jobs in Minnesota and attract jobs to Minnesota. We have in the last 6 months been subject to some discouraging news about our economy. The 23,000 job loss numbers we saw last fall, late summer, the performing less well than the national statistics on unemployment and also job growth, which is a new situation for us. And most troubling is that our state economists reported to us that we're really not sure what's going on. We're really kind of stumped at this point as to what exactly is driving this less than historically good performance relative to the national economy, and why our job situation is looking so bad at this time. In this climate, when we reflect upon what the strengths of Minnesota are, Minnesota has always had an excellent record for innovation and for research and development. It's led to growth in jobs here and internationally. We have one of the highest patents in the country and patent numbers of patents for our firms. We are the third highest in the Midwest in terms of R&D, and we are the 10th highest nationally in R&D in the last many years. In addition, in terms of what contributed to this, there are many, many factors, most of them having just to do with the private sector and the kinds of firms that started here. But in addition to this, Minnesota was the first state in the country to have a research and development credit along the lines of the federal one. It was enacted in 1982. And so we led the way in the issue of R&D credits for private firms, enacted 1 year after the federal law. What you have before you for discussion as we move forward in trying to address these problems we face is one approach to trying to encourage even further R&D investment in our state and to attract firms to our state and to keep the firms that we have. One would have to weigh this because obviously there's a revenue impact of R&D credits. Weigh the increase in R&D credits versus alternative uses of those revenues in terms of either, further support for public research and development, because this is private research and development, or other avenues to spur economic growth in our state. Many of the firms we have learned recently, many of the firms that help spur this tremendous growth, you know, whether it's 3M or Medtronic or IBM, et cetera, we have had some reports recently of further movement of portions of their operations overseas. Now, while tax climate is credit, most of that is being driven by the fact that demand for their goods and services is moving overseas. Not moving overseas, it is growing overseas faster than it has here domestically, so they logically are having to move some of their operations. What we hope to do, though, by having a very positive R&D tax credit climate, though, is to at least continue to retain the headquarters and the research centers of these major corporations in the state of Minnesota, and that's what this kind of legislation can contribute to. So to the specifics, so the goal here is both for larger firms, you know, what we might do to help them retain their headquarters and their research operations here as we move forward into the future, and then for smaller firms to encourage them to do greater R&D investment. And to lower the cost of doing business and research and development in Minnesota relative to the other states. The economic literature on this does indicate that R&D credits are effective for lowering the cost of doing R&D and do attract firms from other states to the states that offer those R&D credits. As I indicated, we do already have one, so the question is whether or not it would be worthwhile to increase these credits or otherwise alter the way they currently function to make this an even more attractive state for encouraging research and development in the private sector. This particular bill has three primary features. The first is altering and making the tax credit itself more attractive. In your bill summary, if you want to take a look at the front page, there's a table that kind of sums that up. And it's that currently we offer such a tax credit for research expenditures over $2 million. This bill would lower that to $250,000. So that's a significant change there. It also would double the tax credit available to them from 5% to 10%, and then at the top tier, over $250,000, from 2.5% to 5%. So we are doubling the tax rates that are available, and we're also lowering the threshold at which you go from a Tier 1 to a Tier 2. So a significant increase in the encouragement for R&D in terms of lowering the cost of doing R&D in the state. Secondly, unlike current legislation, this tax credit would be refundable. The maximum tax credit you can receive is up to your tax liability. So you can't, receive something greater than your actual tax liability. This legislation actually allows you to exceed your actual tax liability and actually get a refundable credit. Not only that, it would be retroactive 15 years. So if in the past you have had credits greater than your liability, you could actually go back and capture those credits. They would carry forward. So that's the second main feature. third, current law, you can only use this credit against your regular tax, and this extends it to the AMC alternative minimum tax in addition to the regular tax. In terms of the revenue impact, it's not insignificant, so we have to weigh this in relation to what the other options are for exploring further research and development and corporate growth in Minnesota and job growth in Minnesota. As you see from your fiscal notes, and fiscal 2009, it's $41 million, and it goes down to $24 million in the following two time periods. It's front-loaded because of that carryover from previous years of the net refundable portion over the liability. That's why there's a bigger hit in the first year. So that's a quick overview of it, and I'd be glad to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Bunn. Did you have any testifiers here?
I did not bring testifiers.
Okay. Is there anyone from the public here who would like to testify for or against? Okay. If not, Representative Fulbert.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, how does going back 15 years to pick up a tax break that we're giving now encourage future research and development?
Mm-hmm. Representative Bunn.
Well, that's a good question. This bill, in its original, well, this bill was drafted, was started by my senator. There are a few quirky features to this, and that's one of them, and the AMT is the other that I am not as certain about the logic for it. In terms of why, I agree with you. If the issue is moving forward, unless the staff has another view on this, why it might be in there. But in terms of moving forward, if you want to incur expansion or increases in research, I would think that we could start from now going forward and lower the fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up then. Is there some way that this could be drafted, as you talked about, of keeping corporate headquarters in the state? If we allow this, can we put a hook on corporate headquarters, such as we have a hook on when we help Northwest Airlines? It may not be a big hook, but it's going to, they're going to have to pay. And so if we allow this, and if one of the goals of this bill is to keep or encourage corporate headquarters in the state, I think we should then say, if you're going to get this benefit, you got to keep your corporate headquarters in the state. I don't have any language now, but it's a thought.
Further questions for Representative Bunn, Representative Zellers, and Wolfweiger. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Bunn, when one of your colleagues was here, I think it was last week, Representative Winkler had a provision with a different flavor, but kind of the same thing. And in all fairness, we have to ask the question, and I actually support legislation that you're bringing forward, but the chair and several different committees have said that research and development credits, corporate subsidies, are off the table. And again, saying I do support your bill and the idea of bringing forward, this is off the table. Just curious of your comments.
Let me see if I understood, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Did you just say that the leadership and your chair have said they're off the table? And so who are you saying they're off the table? Okay, you're saying they're off the table.
Well, Representative, I don't know about leadership, but I know the chair has made the point
Representative, if I may, in this tax committee, we have had a lot of discussion about credits in general, and R&D credits in particular. We have heard Representative Winkler's bill, Representative Damia's bills, Representative Mahoney, Representative Paulson has been a strong advocate for the R&D credits. There's bipartisan for, and there is bipartisan against. But what I've tried to have folks think about is, and we'll see what everyone in this room is going to do in a couple of weeks here, is one way in the deficit to solve the problem we have is to stop spending money on corporate subsidies to help us get out of the deficit. We are of two minds in this room, and it does not follow on partisan lines, but we're going to learn about that as we start having roll call votes. So, Representative Bunn, comments on your thoughts on that?
Well, all the two quick comments. First of all, in terms of you mentioned the Winkler bill and some of the others, they do all kind of address different kind of portions of the corporate and small and startup kind of markets in terms of the size of firms and the types of firms. Some of the other legislation goes more for startups that don't really have income yet that could be taxable and things like that for kind of smaller firms. In terms of this general issue, when I put my kind of economist hat on and I had a little conversation earlier today, the literature on this is mixed in terms of economic research. Clearly, from a state-specific basis, states can benefit from competing in this way to attract and retain firms and to lower the cost of doing research in their state. From a national perspective, there's no net gain for the country, is what most of the research shows. And so, as in so many areas, whether it's sports stadiums or tax credits, whether you think the state should engage in this kind of competition is an important area of debate and discussion. And particularly when there's dollars involved like there is here, I think you have to carefully examine, you know, even if it's for encouraging research and development, where the best, you know, what might be, you know, public versus private, small versus large, all those kinds of things are important to weigh in the discussion.
And if I may, before Representative, did we have Representative Zeller? Simmons, Representative, nope. Okay, Representative Wolfire is waiting in Simpson and Rod. But I did want to just clarify something, and I'm going to ask Mr. Michael if that's all right, Representative Bunn. There is a piece in here about how the current R&D credit is at some level based on gross receipts or sales, and so Representative Bunn's bill is treating folks more broadly depending on how they claim a credit if they're part of a unitary business, and so kind of what's going on there in that change in her bill. Can you clarify for us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Representative Bunn indicated, her bill has some quirky features, one of which is the bill fundamentally, as she points out, makes the credit refundable. And the reason I refer to this as being a little bit quirky is because the fact that it's refundable means that the state is essentially going to pay these corporations the amount of their credit without regard to whether they have tax liability. But what makes the bill a little quirky is there's another feature that allows the business, a unitary business with multiple corporations, to shift the credits among those corporations to use up all their tax liability, which seems unnecessary if you're actually going to get a refund. If the bill did not have the refundability feature, that would help some businesses out that have liability in some corporations where the credit entitlements are not located, and therefore they can't sort of optimize the use of all of their credits. But the fact that the bill also has this refundability feature sort of trumps that or makes it unnecessary.
Okay. Thank you. And I just want to understand, and Representative Bunn, we will not hold you accountable for anything your senator is proposing here.
Madam Chair, I did try this last week and even today to get further clarification as to the source of that quirkiness and what its intent was, and I did not get a clear answer. So as we move forward this week, we'll see if we can clarify why the original drafter felt that was an important feature.
Well, and you should know we're very good at dismantling bills here.
Yes.
And taking the pieces we like.
Yeah.
And we do that on all kinds of bills, yeah, including everybody around the table. So that's just, there's no problem there. Representative Wolfire.
Chair, Representative Bunn, I'm looking at the Minnesota revenue sheet. And on the back it says that 95% of the revenue loss is concentrated in about 50 taxpayers.
The revenue...
It says about 95% of revenue loss is concentrated in about 50 taxpayers who claim R&D credit.
Mm-hmm.
So then I look at the front of the page, and just for simplicity, I looked at fiscal year 2010, because 50 divided into 24.3 is easier for me for some reason. So that's like $500,000 per person.
Per company, public company. Madam Chair, sorry. This particular legislation does capture larger firms relative to some of the legislation, Linkwich and others, that are focused more on the smallest.
and that's why that unitary provision is in there as well. That's what that's about as well. So we are talking about, I mean, the 3Ms and other companies would also benefit from this. So there are, while it affects, I believe, total, it says it's about 250 firms, the largest portion of it is accrued to 50 firms that engage in a great deal of R&D investment.
Further questions or promotions?
Okay. That's, now, they would lose, the state would lose for
I understand that. You know, on the surface, your bill looks great, but then as you read the details, it really boils down to about 50.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bunn, it's nice to have another person out here on our in the House looking out for Minnesota businesses. I appreciate that.
President Bunn, I don't know if you heard that one. I was just said, uh-oh, what's coming next?
No, but I just have a simple question. How does this change over your proposed financial revenue sheet shows Representative Volkswagen stated, $41 million and then $24 million. Under present law, how much will we be paying out in 08, 09, 010? That's all I'm asking.
Representative Bunn. So I assume these are the increase relative to current law, and I actually do not know the answer to that in terms of what we're currently paying out in terms of tax credit. This would be the net addition to that that we pay under this provision. So given that we're doubling, and maybe Joel Michaels staff could assist with this, but given that we're doubling the credits, I don't know quite how that would transfer directly. The percentage-wise, it could be that this is a 50% or so increase in what we're currently doing. I'm not sure if it directly would translate that way.
Representative Simpson, further? Would you like that?
Mr. Michaels, he would like to comment.
Mr. Michaels.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I don't have the exact number, but it's on the order of about $20 million. So this is more than a doubling. And, of course, the reason for that is that there are some companies now who can't really use all of their entitlements. First of all, as Representative Bunn points out, this sort of doubles the rate, but then there's also some fall-off because companies can't use it all, and the refundability makes that up, so that's why it's more than just the rate increase.
Thank you.
Okay.
Further questions? Representative LaFleur.
Madam Chair, thank you. I had a question for Representative Bunn, especially since we're moving to a refundable-type credit. You didn't have any witnesses here tonight, and I'm wondering what data do we have to show that this investment of taxpayer dollars really has sort of a but-for test that we're used to? I mean, what evidence do we have that there are going to be firms out there that will engage in further research and development that they otherwise would not because of this taxpayer expenditure? And I think of a lot of fine Minnesota firms and companies, and they do very good work, but I can't help but think a lot of their research and development would already take place even in the absence of this credit. And I'm just curious if, being trained as you are in this field, is what kind of data that we have.
I alluded earlier to there's a study done by the San Francisco Federal Reserve looking nationally at the impact of states providing research R&D credits. And that data indicates that, in fact, it does have a significant increase for those states in a positive direction, that there's a net benefit to them. And the question is whether that's a net nationally or not, and that's probably not. But for the states involved in doing it, there is a net benefit.
Okay. Well, is it offline or anything, if we had some of our larger employers like 3M that be interested, we don't have to have committee testimony, but if they could even drop a line or something like that, then... I know Representative Solberg, Representative Rukavina's got the boilerplate clawback provisions in his jacket pocket for those corporate benefits.
Madam Chair, I think that is a legitimate question, and that's a legitimate question we're having when jobs ease as well. But for would that ever happen? And that's the biggest question we always have to ask. And my experience with Job Z is that that but-for isn't being met.
So Representative Bunn, your bill is right on par with what we're working on this year, and I guess I will just say to you that when we heard a bill I had to repeal the R&D credits, we heard some testifiers from the business community who
explained why we needed to keep the R&D credits. And I said to them, and I will say to you, that I think you and Representative Paulson and Winkler and Dabney and Mahoney and those who, you know a lot about the current R&D credits and those who want to change them or bring new ones, it'd be great if folks could try to think through some sort of mass compromise that still generated revenue. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because with no ability to raise taxes currently and a deficit, I just think the tax committee has to get a lot more surgical in what it's going to do. And the corporate subsidiary is an area to look and maybe target some companies for these things. And we've heard arguments that the reason R&D doesn't work that great in Minnesota is because we just don't give them enough. Mm-hmm. It's too anemic. And then we've heard arguments the other side, it doesn't work because it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, the truth is in the perspective of the company that either is the recipient or might be, or the author, or the behavior they're trying to change. And I just think on net, since we all have to be in a cutting mode, I hope all the folks who are really interested in this, and there are a lot, could start trying to think about what might be a surgical targeted R&D credit to do what, mm-hmm. and repeal others and be able to mm-hmm. buy those with repealing some and still leave mm-hmm. some revenue. And I think that's how we could politically actually pass something in this committee. But I think if folks don't act, then we'll probably mm-hmm. presume we'll just maybe repeal some of the R&D credits and mm-hmm. do nothing, you know, going forward with them. But mm-hmm. just a thought. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of folks thinking about this. Representative,
Madam Chair, I think that's an excellent suggestion, and I think I will maybe work with the others to try to get us to have a meeting among ourselves and come back with you to you with some ideas along those lines as to how we might do that. I think it's an excellent idea, and that's an excellent time to bring to bear some of this further evidence from the corporations that were from at different levels in the state or other economic research that points to some answers on this.
Thank you. It's a tough group, may I say,
that you'd be working with Representative Folger, Brock, Hillary.
Ma'am, just a question to counsel probably. Does the state offer some kind of a deduction anyway if a corporation gives money to, let's say, the University of Minnesota for a specific research and development project?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair,
or some other entity that would do the public entity.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, there is a charitable contribution deduction for corporations as well as individuals that allowed at the federal level and flows through to Minnesota through our use of federal taxable income. So within there are percentage limits that apply, but rarely do any corporations, you know, give enough to, you know, get up over those percentage limits. They're not regarded as business expenses, but it is allowed as a charitable contribution. So,
okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just since you're in the cutting mode, I know you're going to be juggling all sorts of things going forward, I was just going to offer up a suggestion to you that one of the best ways that we might be able to get revenue in the state is if we actually cut the corporate taxes so that these businesses would have less inhibitors in terms of creating jobs in our community. So just want to throw that out to you as a suggestion.
With that big smile. Thank you, Representative Broad. And Representative Broad, yeah, as you know, for the tax committee, that's a spending item, but
Madam
I agree
Chair?
With you. That would be
I would agree wholeheartedly with Representative Broad if she would personally guarantee that.
Madam Chair, well, I'd be happy to do that if Representative Solberg could guarantee that the Senate didn't attach anything onto any of our bills.
No, I'm not talking about, Madam Chair, about the personal guarantee of the bright future when we do away with all corporate tax.
Well, Madam Speaker and the Representative, or Madam Speaker, I'm sorry, congratulations, Madam Chair and Representative Solberg. I believe in the innovation of Minnesotans, and I absolutely believe that if they have the barriers removed and if they have less inhibitors to creating jobs, that we absolutely will go great places.
And I should say, Representative Bond, you're just getting roped into this, but this is the fun of the tax committee. You know, the governor is cutting the sales tax. The governor is proposing to cut the sales tax. In a bill I offered, I proposed to cut the corporate tax. The governor is proposing to cut the sales tax. And I think realistically, probably of most importance to this room, I would guess bipartisanly, but I can't speak to everyone, is probably to cut the property tax. So we are going to try to do something. All of those require spending, though, for the tax committee to do that. Representative Mullery.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just wondering.
Well, another R&D person. I forgot about you.
I was
yeah.
wondering, did you just write my bill off, which was interesting because a former...
I forgot about you. Mullery.
The other one.
Mullery, right here.
Actually, my bill is the one that was designed by a former doctor who was a staff at the committee who spent a whole summer doing research on the most effective R&D credits. And so I'm wondering if you're throwing away all that research.
Yeah, Representative Mullery is another person who's very interested in R&D credits. So, okay, are there further questions? If not, we're going to lay over Representative Bond's bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax. So thank you, Representative Bond.
Thank you.
Representative Dammey.
Madam Chair, if I could just comment.
Yes, please.
Last week, the committee heard Representative Marquardt's job Z bill. And members may recall that one of the handouts was from the city of Cambridge touting the use of Job Z to relocate us from there, from Bourbon, Minnesota, to rural Minnesota. And the question was raised about Job Z simply moving jobs back and forth across the state and it not being a gain. The question then was raised, well, we don't know what happened to the state that business had occupied in St. Louis Park. Perhaps it has been filled, can't always be good with the world. I contacted, if I remember correctly, David Hunt, but don't hold me to that, the economic development staffer for the city of St. Louis Park. And the place where Waterworks, I think it was called, is located is Bacon.
And is what?
Bacon.
Bacon. Okay.
So Job Z served simply to move jobs from the metro area to a Job Z location, and there was not a balancing of additional job growth in the metro area to balance off that loss. So, since we had the discussion and debate, I thought I'd follow up on my follow up.
So it was a Democratic.
Yes. And that's all part of the thing. Okay. Thank you for that, Representative Emmy. Thank you again, Representative Bond. Appreciate that. And let's see, we've got Representative Kalin. Is he here? Or Representative Coonan?
Republican
No, she's not here. I'm going to do this bill. So, yes. Yeah. We either Representative Kalin or Representative Coonan is here, so we can take Representative Coonan's bill. And Representative Coonan moves House File 3585. And members, Representative Thiessen was called away and had to leave, and I actually am going to ask, I'm going to move his bill and ask staff, who I have not told this till this very moment, to help, and others who may be authors, to help us introduce and hear Representative Thiessen's bill so we can get that done tonight. But he did have to leave, and he has a number of testifiers. So, Representative Coonan, please. And I think Representative Coonan has an amendment so that his objectives can move on, but the tax provisions can stay here. So, Representative Coonan, do you have the amendment? It's coming. Okay, so we're going to...
Madam Chair, I have another amendment, too, that removes the Met Council, so that we'd be looking...
Okay, so we have a couple.
You can
pass them both out. Pass them both out, and then... So, Representative Coonan, we're getting now the 1547 amendment, and I know this is the removal of the Met Council to give it in the order you want it. We'll wait till all members have it, and I don't know that you yourself even have a copy yet.
I do.
So, Representative Coonan moves the 08-1547 amendment to remove the Met Council. Are there questions to this amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. And then, Representative Coonan, did you want to just go to the second one as well? So we have the bill. I don't know if there is a second one. Is there a second amendment?
No, we're just going to do it orally.
Oh, oral amendment. Okay. Representative Coonan, how would you like to proceed? Just to the bill, or do you want to do your oral amendment to take those tax sections out?
I guess it doesn't matter. We can go either way.
However you'd like.
I'll present the bill first.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. What this bill does is allow counties to collaborate on seabed projects to promote wind energy development in Minnesota. And this is authority that cities already have, so that's what this bill does, is bring counties up to that level. It grants authority to counties to generate, buy, and sell electricity from wind at wholesale. I should add, though, that it does not allow counties to be involved in retail business, so this is strictly wholesale. It allows counties financing through the use of tax-exempt bonds, and this will provide the ability to make long-term, it also provides the ability to make long-term purchases of renewable electricity at a predetermined rate. And this is something that's been worked on for the last couple of years anyway between metro counties and some rural counties in southwestern Minnesota. And they've involved, for over a year now, they've involved the utilities in this discussion, and so this is a bill that everybody's in agreement with. The utilities that were actively involved were the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, GRE, and Xcel Energy. And I do have two testifiers here, Madam Chair. So
thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome. Madam Chair, Bob Fox, Regional County Commissioner, and Vice Chair of the Rural Minnesota Energy Board. This legislation reflects the refinement of regulations introduced last year after long discussion with our stakeholders. And this bill is going to provide a tool to attract private capital, which is consistent with the conventional models for wind development. And that's all I'll say.
Excuse me, was it Mr. Fox and Renville County Commissioner?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for that, and welcome.
Okay, I'm Peter McLaughlin from the Hennepin County Board. Thank you for the chance to appear tonight. We buy over $7 million worth of electricity every year at Hennepin County. So we've got a stake in development of new sources of renewable energy and in stabilizing the price of that energy. We think this bill will help us to do both of those things. We've worked with a coalition of 8 counties in the metropolitan area, 17 counties in greater Minnesota, to craft this bill. We've worked with the utilities, and they're in agreement with this bill. And what it's going to allow us to do is to accelerate the development of wind energy in greater Minnesota, keep the money from that development in Minnesota by allowing seabed projects to move forward. It's also going to allow us to use the authority granted last year to Winona County to generate wind energy as counties, and it's going to create financing mechanisms that will permit us to participate in the marketplace that exists for the generation of wind projects. But the key thing here is accelerating the generation of wind projects and keeping the resources in Minnesota while stabilizing the price and allowing Hennepin and the other counties in the metropolitan area to be consuming clean, green energy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner McLaughlin. And I should say, those of us who represent Hennepin County, I believe there was a Hennepin County delegation meeting today, and I think we all missed it. We were on the floor. Were you there?
I was there, and we understood why you weren't.
The pizza,
so.
Sorry about all that.
You missed some pizza.
Yes, that's what I heard. Questions for Mr. Fox, or Commissioner Fox, Commissioner McLaughlin, or Representative Coonan, or Representative Cole? Oh, I'm sorry. A few more. Representative Coles, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe Representative Coonan, I'm not terribly familiar with seabed projects and energy policy in general. It's not my specialty, but help me understand what we're doing here. Are we creating a vehicle by which counties can invest in these projects? Because I thought I heard you say that they're not going to be involved in the retail. So what... what is it exactly that we're allowing our counties to do that they can't do now, and why? Because I still don't understand the why. What's the gap or the gap we're trying to fill or the problem we're trying to solve?
Madam Chair, Representative, I look at it as this bill would give us a tool for the toolbox. We have a seabed project that might be in my district or in my area, and maybe they're short some funding. And maybe it's 5% or 10%. And if we're not able to step in and do that 5%, maybe we're going to lose this economic development. And that's really what we're trying to do with this. It's just going to be small little pieces is the way I look at it.
Madam Chair, from our side, metro area, the large consumption of electricity, we are trying to find ways that we can stabilize the price of electricity. And we're not going to enter into these contracts if it's a bad economic deal for the metropolitan area. This is going to allow also us to help to create projects where the where it would be wind power, and the wind power would be generated right here in the state of Minnesota, and the resources could stay here in Minnesota.
Tim Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For either of the commissioners, if this goes forward and counties get involved in these projects, is it going to result in higher property taxes or lower property taxes?
Madam Chair, as on the consumer end of this, primarily, as a large county that's here in the metropolitan area, we think it's going to help reduce the pressures on property taxes by stabilizing a large cost element in our budget, $7 million in our case, for electricity purchases. We think it's going to be going to help us to stabilize those costs.
That sounds close.
Madam Chair, maybe for Representative Coonan or one of the other witnesses, if they can answer, is the cost of wind generation more or less than the cost of generation, coal-based, coal-fired generation or other electrical generation?
Representative Coonan.
Madam Chair, I'm not on the Energy Committee, but I do understand that it's competitive, and maybe one of these gentlemen have a more detailed answer for you, but that's my understanding. It's competitive.
I guess I can't tell you exactly if it's between coal and electric, but if we're looking at the cost of energy, the cost of energy is going like this, where wind generation, and you provide a power purchase agreement for, say, 20 years, and that level is going to be constant. And so that's the big difference, where it's going to be a cost savings down the road with the more wind generation that we get done.
Madam Chair, marginal cost is competitive if you get a project of sufficient magnitude. And one of the things that we're trying to do here is to allow for the aggregation of the purchase of turbines so that they can be constructed in three or four different counties, but it could be done as one purchase, which would allow a competitive price to be bid in the marketplace by aggregating more than two or three turbines. If you put more together, you're going to get a better price. That's the nature of the market.
Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, I'll be brief and then I'll be done. But Commissioner McLaughlin, I certainly agree that that's the nature of the market. But it seems as though we're popping up a market with government intervention and. We have a lot of discussions around here about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, and I'm a big supporter of alternative energy, wind energy. But I'm not saying that I'm for or against the bill. I'm just trying to understand why it is we would want to give counties the ability to do this. I'm not sure that there's a huge problem today, but Madam Chair, I'll leave it at that. It's an interesting bill, Representative Coonan, and I look forward to. Further discussions with you and considering whether it makes sense to include it in this year's bill.
Okay, so Representative Coonan, you ready for this? It's Simpson, Earhart, Mullery, Zellers, Liebling, Dahmer. Representative Simpson. And Representative Rod. Representative Simpson. And you know, members, and I should just before we go into them all, there is a lot of interest in this, and that's why I explained to, you know, Representative Coonan is going to offer an amendment to leave the public finance provision here, the local bonding, and the ability to levy taxes in this room so we can decide if it's going to go down the tax bill, but the rest will go on. But this is, you know, we should have the discussion on the tax pieces here because that will help us as we decide if it should be down in the tax bill. Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Coonan, I like what you're trying to do with the wind energy. That's not an issue. And seabeds, I think, are a great thing. But if I'm not mistaken, seabeds were basically designed for local investors. And now we're going to put local government into the seabed business. Is that going to be a direct competition with the local investor then?
Madam Chair, no, I don't believe it will. As the commissioners explained, that if there's a project that's 90% of the way there or 95% of the way there, that doesn't have quite enough investment to get over the edge that the counties could backfill in to complete the project. You got to keep in mind that cities already have this. I mean, it's in statute already. So what this bill also does is just bring the counties up to the same level that cities already are as far as being able to be involved in these projects.
Commissioner Fox.
Madam Chair and Representative, the biggest problem in the seabed field right now is the passive tax problem, which is a federal IRS problem. And that's the biggest reason right now why we don't see more seabed projects. So with this little bit of help that we could give economic development to rural Minnesota, is just a small little piece. I'll guarantee you there's no counties, especially the 17 counties that I represent here today, we're not going to go out and start building 100 megawatt wind farm. You know, it's going to be a small little piece. We do have a piece that we've been awarded an LCMR grant to develop a small 10 megawatt project, and we're in the process of working on that, but we're not in the idea of getting the big, huge wind farm business.
Well, I guess I look at this, and you're going to use tax-exempt bonds, so that's something that a local seabed investor, local investors wouldn't have the ability to use. And the way I read this, you can levy up to a 0.015 property tax levy. Now, that's something that a local investor group wouldn't have. So I guess those just are things that, to me, look like it really takes the counties into a different league of play than what that local investment group is doing now. The six farmers that went together and put one of these seabeds together certainly don't have tax-exempt bonds, and they certainly don't have levy ability. So just kind of help me get through it. I'm not against what you're trying to do, but I'm questioning how you're getting there, I guess.
Mr. Fox? Or
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess there's also some other tools that those six farmers and their project might have something to that the counties can't get, like a federal grant or whatever, you know. We're just trying to get on a level playing field with the other groups. The utilities support us. You know, we see this as part of the way that the legislation that you sponsored last year and was passed of this 25% by 2025, and just using this small tool as a little piece of economic development tool in rural Minnesota. Now, I don't think we're going to go out and compete with any six farmers. I mean, if six farmers can go out and do this project, I mean, I have a farmer, some farmers right outside my district, and they're looking to come into my district a little bit as a possibility. I'm not going to go out and compete against those guys, not in the least. But if they run into a problem, because it takes 4 or 5 years to put these projects together, if they come along and they've worked 5 to 7 years, invested their time in this, and then they say, you know, we're 5% short or we're 10% short, it's either going to fall apart or we're going to have to find 10%. That's where I want to help them. That's it.
Thank you for that, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Manager. I'm really coming out of job D zone for the counties here too to really keep this thing rolling. That sounds like you haven't asked for that yet. Can I amend your bill for that purpose? It seems to me that
you were serious.
We're just gonna keep laughing.
That's in your heart.
It seems to me, Madam Chair, and hope sure that we'd be better off giving the tax credit or other incentives to private industry and let them go out there and create the jobs, and also help the investors in this thing. If we would give enough incentive, we'd probably get the same action and get better commission to go off and we're not agreed.
I'm sure, Representative Earhart, there's not a whole lot of financial incentive from the public sector that's built into this proposal. It's primarily permitting the aggregation of these projects, so that you could actually, in response to the previous question, we may be able to do a cookie cutter here, so if there's six farmers in Renville County, six farmers in Watonwan County, and six farmers in Blue Earth County, we may be able to put together similar projects, go out in the marketplace, buy the turbines in one bid, use the same legal structure, and actually allow these farmers to succeed. I mean, these seabed projects have been very difficult to put together. Excel will tell you that, how difficult it's been to put them together. This is essentially allowing these seabed projects to actually compete in the marketplace as it exists now. And there are some bases on which these projects have a difficult time competing now, but it's not primarily about a subsidy, and the investment that local government might make in these is very modest, 15/1,000th of 1% of the base, and that's money that we're only going to invest
if it makes sense long term for our counties as consumers of electricity.
Well, Madam Chair, it looks to me like you have the ability to levy a property tax, issue general obligation bonds without an election, and then you have to have debt service on the general obligation bonds, which has got to come from, like, the taxpayers.
Madam Chair,
Commissioner McLaughlin.
Commissioner Gerhardt, would not be our intention to enter into those contracts unless it actually, we could get into a contract that would guarantee us that our electricity prices aren't going to go up. So, I mean, we can find a way here to hedge the price of electricity by entering into these contracts. We don't have the authority to do that now. And in fact, as I understand, it was an oversight that counties weren't permitted to participate in seabed projects last year. I mean, we actually, some of the counties went down the road thinking that counties were actually in and were permitted to do it, and the attorneys took a look at it, and the word that we got back was that if counties are going to participate in seabed, they need an explicit grant of authority. And so the seabed portion of this is that explicit grant of authority, which some counties actually thought was in the law last year.
Mr. McLaughlin, in the law, the reference to in the law last year, is there somebody, Reverend Coonan or Commissioner McLaughlin, who knows what this law is of last year? I mean, it wasn't in the tax bill. I don't.
No.
You know, I don't. Is that the, whose committee is that? So, I mean, I guess the tax pieces that are here is the local bonding and the ability to levy. And was that granted to this, to whoever it was granted to last year? Does anybody know that? Because if my understanding is Winona County got some authority to do something, and if they got the ability to either bond locally or raise the levy, I'm wondering how they got past the tax committee, quite honestly. I'm just going to marvel at that if they did that, but I think maybe they don't have those authorities. They have the ability to generate the electricity. Does anyone know that? And I think we're all just kind of confused because I don't think this committee has any knowledge of this last year proposal. Is anybody? I don't know if anyone can tell us what happened last year.
If I may, Madam Chair,
yes.
Members of the committee. My name is Tony Hingelt. I'm with Hennepin County Environmental Services staff.
Welcome.
Thank you. Section 1 of the bill just refers simply to the CBIT authority. CBIT authority, okay. As the CBIT statute was passed. When CBIT was passed, in fact, it uses the word county, but it does not, that doesn't mean that counties have the authority. Attorneys have told us that unless we have the explicit authority, then we don't have it. This, in fact, okay. Section 1 of the bill, it proceeds from, it is included in the CBIT task force. Okay. Which just reported their report on March 28th includes the recommendation that this portion of this bill be passed. Section 2 of the bill extends to all counties what was granted to Winona County last year. So that was the authority that was presented last year.
You know, we can hang on one second because we all just don't remember that.
Last year, there was...
Winona County was allowed
right.
to do public bonding.
Nope. I'm sorry. Section 3 includes the bonding portion of the bill. The reason the bonding
portion... No, this bill, but we don't believe this reference to someone last year getting this authority, I don't think that took place. I think Section 1 took place for a county, but all the other sections did not.
Madam Chair,
and if somebody can correct us on that...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 2 does not include bonding authority. Section 2 replicates a bill that was passed last year that provided the authority to Winona County to generate electricity from wind energy conversion systems and sell that power wholesale to a utility.
Okay, excuse me, I apologize, but I think it actually does in Section 2 on line 1.16 and 1.17 grant authority to issue bonds, which is one of the reasons that I'm trying to leave the public financing part of it here in the tax committee. So you may not be aware of that. You know, I'm not going to hold you to that. I think the tax committee is confused about it because all the local bonding, we're carrying the public finance part of the tax bill, and we're just trying to make sure that Winona County didn't somehow get that authority and we all missed it. because we all kind of track this stuff pretty thoroughly. So I think you're not trying to say that. I think you maybe just didn't know that piece was in there at that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that was an oversight on my part.
Yes, no problem. No, we're all learning it too. Yep. So no problem there. Okay, so you had further comments? Because I think what we would like to do, as I've expressed to Representative Coonan, I think, and he's got an amendment that Mr. Michael can read, would be to leave the local levy authority and the local public financing authority here in this committee for consideration for the omnibus tax bill, but to move Section 1 on, which is the non-tax bill part that was granted for Winona County. Is that your intention, Representative Coonan?
Yes, Madam Chair, and to clarify that Section 2, the reason you want to leave that here is because of the issuing of bonds and certificates. Is that what I understand?
Right, and if it's okay, just before we keep going on questions, can we just take that motion now before we forget it? So Representative Coonan is going to move what Mr. Michael is going to read to us all. So Representative Coonan, this is going to be your motion here that Mr. Michael is going to read. Hang on a second. Okay, Representative Coonan, go ahead.
Madam Chair, before we do that, we were just talking up here. Maybe we should strike that language so that whole section can keep moving.
Representative Coonan, we'll do whatever you want to do. We just want to make sure, just like Representative Broad, you know, in her previous bill tonight and many others, would like to have tax provisions move. We haven't let them, so we can't let these tax provisions move either. And Representative Coonan has no problem with that. We talked about it on the floor. We can do what you need to do, but we just want to leave the tax pieces here. So I don't know if Mr. Michael has a further thought on a motion. While Mr. Michael takes a look at that, can we keep going on questions, Representative Coonan? Does that work for you?
Yes. Yeah,
okay, fine. Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, it's so long ago I forgot. I was just going to ask Representative Coonan if he wasn't worried that he was killing his bill by having a witness that lived in my city.
Madam Chair, just to Section 1, the local government and subdivision powers, that authority, was that authority given last year to Representative Coonan?
Representative Coonan.
In last year's bill that probably Representative Hilty carried?
Representative Coonan.
That was in 2006?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so Representative Zellers, Liebling, Dammer, Broad. Representative Zellers.
Madam Chair, you actually got to the first part of my question with the issuing of bonds. I'm not that sharp, but I can read, and it does say purchase, issue bonds. In the first part of the sentence, again, it says the county may own, construct, and this is the real red flag, and acquire, purchase, and operate wind energy conversion system. How, dare I ask, are you going to acquire one of these wind energy conversion systems?
Madam Chair, Representative, it could be just that you're going to have a percent of interest in that. I mean, you're going to acquire 5% interest in that LLC of that community debt project. That's the way I take that.
Representative Sauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. That may be fine. I'm just wondering how you're going to do it. Because the choir has a few red flags. When I heard that you and the government are going to stabilize the energy market, that kind of some red flags right away, but then we're going to acquire something and purchase. I thought the way we started off with the bill, we weren't going to purchase any of these materials for this community wind energy conversion system, and it says in here we can purchase, plan, develop, acquire, construct.
Number one, I didn't say we were going to stabilize the market. In fact, we were trying to respond to the instability in the market, the energy market. This is a hedge against the instability. We would acquire through our local, the authority that would be granted in this bill for us to own these facilities, these turbines. And that could be either with property tax or with
with bonds. That's our basic funding authority. That's what this is about. We're trying to do it as a way to deal with the instability in the energy market.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple of us wrote it down that way, so maybe if it was a misstatement, that's we'll take it at that. So my other question, Representative Kuhnhauer, to the commissioners, a lot of these, especially the wind projects, are have either a federal or a state subsidy. Are any of these going to also have those federal subsidies in them?
Madam Chair, Representative,
Commissioner Fox.
You mean when you say federal subsidy, you mean like the federal tax credits and stuff like that? Yes, they would. If you're talking about the tax credits, they would be part of that, especially you know, there's different production tax credits, passive tax credits. It's all part of the mix to put a seabed project together.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm so glad I get to follow Representative Zellers because I have a suggestion for what acquire might mean. Somebody might leave it in their will. Never know. That would be acquiring, but anyway, I'm being a little facetious.
Oh, Madam Chair, in the government's case, take is another word that comes to my mind.
Yeah.
For those of us that are in Hennepin County, we've got a project in mind that kind of, so especially Chair Lanchesky, it's kind of big on our mind that has a construction happening right now, so.
But anyway, Madam Chair, you know, in consideration of the Chair's statement about, you know, we're really here for the tax pieces, but I'm not going to go into all my questions because I really have a lot of questions. I think it's a pretty exciting idea, frankly, and I really like it. I'd like to know more about it because I don't know a lot about energy and all of that. That's not my area either, but I just wanted to say a couple things, and one is that... you know, with the decreases in LGA and the sort of pressures on local governments that we've seen over the last few years, I'm seeing in a lot of different areas that counties are getting really creative about, you know, how to handle some of the pressures, financial pressures on them, and I think it's a great thing. I think we're seeing a lot of good innovation. You know, I have said in another context, in the Health Committee, actually, that you know, we always talk about the states being the laboratories of the country. Well, I think the counties are the laboratories of the state, and I think it's just a great thing. Somebody mentioned something about competition with private investors, and I just wanted to also kind of put the idea out there that, you know, we're going to need lots and lots of renewable energy. So I don't really think that competition is going to be the issue. I think it's great to have complementary generation of renewable power. So, you know... I'm excited to hear about this, and I hope to learn a lot more about it.
Thanks for that. Representative Demmer. Representative Broad. Oh, Representative Demmer. Sorry. And let's see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just,
sorry.
Just pedaling along over here. Sing with all my friends. thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm just as Representative Liebling is happy to be following Representative Zellers. I'm kind of happy to be following Representative Liebling, and I have some concerns. Down in Meyer, I'm from Dodge County. We have lots of projects being worked on down there. There's literally hundreds of windmills that are being proposed. And as you know, Madam Chair, I've been talking a lot about the privately financed development that's going on. And where I'm from, there's absolutely no shortage of people wanting to put in windmills and these wind turbines. And there's no shortage of the capital that's available. What is an issue is where you're going to put them, acquiring the land. And my question, I'm going to reiterate some of the things that have been said about the counties coming in and having, Representative Simpson pointed them out very well, the counties coming in with taxing authority and with the ability to do bonding and that sort of thing, and really to be at a huge advantage to a lot of the private developers, even though there are plenty of private developers who want these tax credits, federal tax credits. My question is, in Section 2, farther down, now maybe we took this up, but bottom line is I don't care where it is. Do the cities and or would the counties under this have the ability to acquire land through like eminent domain or any situations like that where they would deem, could bring a case of public good or whatever and acquire property? That's the question I have.
Representative Kuhnen or Commissioner Fox or Commissioner McLaughlin, anyone?
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be the last thing I would do in my county is do that because that's not going to get you anywhere, any place you want to go. You go in here as a partner. You go in there with a landowner who's got the place that a tower would work. You might go in with a private developer and make a seabed project work for that area or community. We're not going to go in there and start eminent domain and anything like that. That's not what the Rural Minnesota Energy Board is about.
Well, thank you for your answer. I agree with you. I think, quite frankly, you'd have a revolt if you tried to do that. But my question wasn't would you. My question is could you under this bill? Is the authority there to go in and use eminent domain to take property to put in a project? Is the ability there? Whether you would or not is one question. Could you? Is the ability and or the authorization here to do that?
There is no additional granting of authority to use eminent domain in this bill. None.
Representative Demmer, that's a good question because, and it's not a tax committee issue, it's the local gov, but I think everyone remembers this debate. I mean, I think that the eminent domain law that passed, which I opposed, I mean, I was one of a few, but I think for those who wanted it, granted the government the ability to do public purpose eminent domain still. So this isn't asking for more, but I think it currently does, and that's what passed. So I guess it was Jeff Johnson and Paul Thiessen were kind of the experts on that in the House, and does anyone know the answer to that? I mean, it seems you probably could, but I think you can in current law.
I apologize. I guess I kind of got off our topic here, but it popped into my mind right away, especially when we talked about the powers, and I suppose that's a different jurisdiction that we have here, but it's out there now.
And the utilities, they can. Like Excel.
Right. But I guess back on the tax issue, I again would have a concern about county governments and city, I guess, if they have that ability. I don't know, but county is probably a bigger issue. Having the ability to come in and compete with the private sector for these, and I just, in my area anyway, there's no shortage of private sector capital and or projects wanting to go on. The real issue is getting the landowners to go along. That's what's going on. They're all arguing and debating and bidding for properties. So that's the real issue, and that's why that came up with my question. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that. That's my broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do think that public purpose, some enterprising local government could argue that lower energy costs certainly could be deemed to be public purpose. I would imagine underneath the law, both the previous law and the law still that was changed. So that is a question I think that we should delve into a little bit more so we have a better understanding of it. But I'm trying to understand, Madam Chair, the selling of this, you know, the wholesale versus retail. Who can this energy be provided to? And then also related to line 2.3, Representative Clinton, the county's on-site, 2.2, provided for end use from an off-site facility by the county or Metropolitan Council. Can you just tell me what that actually means? I'm not putting my finger on
Clinton,
how that works.
And just to recall, Representative Clinton removed the Met Council references, so that's out, but for the county. So all the Met Council stuff's gone, but Representative Clinton or one of your testifiers, Mr. Fox? Someone in the audience who wants to help out? Who can answer Representative Broad's question?
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes. In those wordings, we're trying to cover everything from the deal if you did a seabed project where you'd have a power purchase agreement to the site where if I was in Renville County and just outside the city of Olivia, we had a tower and we bought that power right back into our courthouse. You know, that would be your off-site facility. So, I mean, it's trying to hit all projects, whether a county would have the availability, like what Winona was trying to do last year, to where we're trying to help the county go the other route to work into that.
So, just to understand, then, that the electricity would be purchased specifically for county use.
Senator Fox.
Madam Representative, there could be one piece of that would be for, say you had a wind generation, one tower for a courthouse or whatever. Another project could be a seabed project where you would work with Great River Energy or Xcel, whoever, and get a power purchase agreement and just do your seabed project.
Madam Chair, if I could just add.
Yes.
There's a specific provision here
that says that this does nothing to change the exclusive service territories of the utility. So this is not, that's the retail. We're not going to deliver any power at retail. So we can't get into the business of selling electricity to individual customers. We can produce it for our own use, or we can sell it to the local monopoly retail provider, and then they can then sell it through their system. But we can't get into that business under this law. Okay. We don't want to get into this.
I think that's Representative Broad's concern, is that assurance. Representative Broad.
Well, Madam Chair, what I'm trying to understand is on lines 1.12, it says that the local government political subdivision may plan, develop, purchase, etc., and may sell output from that project. So if the local government is buying into something and purchasing, it's different than if they're selling it. So I'm trying to get a sense of who they're selling it to under the language in the bill. Even if it's wholesale, I'm trying to get a sense of who they're selling it to, because it seems to me that from what I'm hearing, it's more of a purchase than a sale.
Mr. McLaughlin, who can they sell it to? If you are Hennepin County, you do this, and you use a bunch, and then you have some extra.
Okay.
Who can you sell it to?
We could sell it to XL Energy, for example, as the retail provider, and then they would, as a wholesale transaction, and then they would, that would then be a source of electricity that they would have available that they could then use to provide to their retail customers.
Okay.
We could sell it to various co-ops or other retail providers of electricity.
Representative Broad.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess some of the other, I have a whole host of concerns. I think the idea is interesting, but I think it needs to be worked on quite a bit. But part of the concern I have is that there's a provision in here that allows for the raising of property taxes for the purpose of creating one of these projects, which in theory is intended to lower the cost of energy. So I'm trying to get the logic behind raising property taxes to lower energy costs for people who may have to pay more once the energy is then sold to XL Energy and then sold back to the ratepayer. So I'm just trying to figure out the circle of life in this provision. And it just seems to me that, I mean, property taxpayers and ratepayers aren't necessarily aligned in most communities because of the way the territories. And I'm just thinking about even some of the communities that I represent that have both municipal utilities as well as other utilities, and how these things all work together in terms of who's paying what. So you have a property taxpayer having their taxes increase, which is a certainty if the tax is levied, to lower the cost of energy, which is speculative and they may never see. So I'm just trying to understand how this all fits together.
Mr. McLaughlin.
Well, Madam Chair, it's in the event that there were a property tax investment, it would be to produce electricity that then would be, for example, we could put it into our public works garage out in Medina. Put a windmill up out there, and they would have then a source of electricity, and you can get good engineering work, and you can predict what the cost of that electricity is going to be. And there's no variation in the fuel price. You've got that nailed down. If there's extra electricity, you could then sell that to the local utility out there, and then they buy it or not buy it. If it's a good purchase price for them, then it becomes part of the electricity that they then distribute, and it would then also be electricity that they could use to meet the requirements that they have for producing renewable energy. So you can have, and we know for sure we're spending over $7 million a year in Hennepin County on electricity. And so we do have an interest in trying to stabilize that cost or reducing it long term. And so our folks who watch over the property tax and who look at these investments are going to be watching over this. We have a steam plant in downtown Minneapolis that we own already that helps provide steam for some of the facilities that we own there. So we've been in this business of energy production for some time. And so we don't go in this in a cavalier way. We are looking at a price. Every prediction on the price of electricity has the graph heading north. And we're trying to find a way to stabilize that. And if it doesn't work, we can't get a power purchase agreement for the excess that makes sense, along with the price that we'd have to be paying for the electricity we consume on our own, we won't know. We don't do it.
Madam
Chair, I guess I appreciate your response, Commissioner. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we do around here that has, I think, made the cost of energy increase. And, you know, I think we need to be very careful of now suggesting that property taxes need to increase just so that people, including counties, can pay the rates of the energy costs that are increasing. And so, you know, I'm not hearing a clamoring for property tax increases, and I certainly am hearing a clamoring for property tax decreases. And so I hope that as the legislature considers energy related items, we're not doing things that further bind you, meaning increase the cost to you as a county through the increased cost of energy, which some of the provisions that we've passed over the past number of years have done. And so I think at some point we've got to find some balance. And, you know, while I think the ideas are interesting, I think that we've got to be a little careful of just a there's no limits on the there's no limits on the levy authority. I don't see. I mean, you have a 0.0015 of market value, but there's no limit in terms of the total amount that can be levied for property or for the purposes of doing this. So, I just and also the use of general obligation bonds. I'd be curious if in the legislation that supposedly gave cities the authority or one city the authority, if it gave them that specific bond authority as well, and also the tax authority. It just seems like this is kind of a pretty big stick to solve a different problem. So, Madam Chair, I hope that we really talk about this and maybe understand it a little bit better as it goes forward.
And I appreciate that, Representative Broad. And I do want to point out that, you know, if I think the problem comes in if it's being used somewhere other than, say, what the county would use it for. Because currently, if Pennington County, say, is using X amount of electricity, they're paying for it on the property tax right now.
Right.
I mean, they're taking out of their general fund, which the people within that county are paying the property tax for it. So that's not different. I think I hear Representative Broad talking about is, okay, so what do you do beyond that? And then what about the bonding authority? And that will get hashed out more in the tax committee later. But Commissioner McLaughlin, did you want to respond?
The only point I make is, I mean, you don't have a facility that matches up. The demand for electricity from the facility doesn't match up perfectly with what the wind turbine can produce.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to figure out what to do with the extra energy. And so the answer is, you sell it.
Property tax refund.
You sell it, and you can, you know, then it's a revenue source. Okay. So you sell the electricity that's been produced, and you've got a share in that. So, I mean, it's a matter of, you know, ideally you'd just produce the electricity for your own facility, but, you know, they don't always match up absolutely perfectly, so you've got to have some effective way of selling the power and having it make sense in the marketplace for both property taxpayers and for the utility.
Okay, Representative Broad, then Earhart, Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, then, and if that's the direction it goes, then maybe if you put some language in here that says, and that revenue should be used to buy down property taxes, that would help close the circle. Because right now you have an open circle in terms of the increase in the property tax, which is certain, and the lowering of the cost of energy, which is speculative. And so if you close the circle by dedicating the money back to property tax decreases or to property tax levies, then that might help allay some of those concerns. This was a suggestion.
Thank you for that.
The only way I make the $7 million electricity bill go down is if I shut the lights off at the jail, the hospital, the workhouse, another place. I mean, I need
the jail and the workhouse.
There is a demand. Oh, okay, there you go.
Yes, I'm so glad. Well, Madam Chair, you know,
he's going to come and throw the switch.
Yeah, there you go. Commissioner, I wish that you were here last year when we had the discussion over how utilities were going to decrease their usage, their conservation usages by 1.5%. You know, at that point, if they're saying, okay, we want to conserve, great, but the demand is increasing. So how do you do that? Well, you're going to shut off your jail switch and your hospitals. I mean, it is about priorities. And so I appreciate what you're saying, but it seems to me that I'd shut down the skating rink first.
Don't have it. But
thank you for that. Representative Earhart.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondering if you've considered other, for instance, doesn't your garbage burning facilities, is that the only steam producer and no electricity?
Mr. McLaughlin.
Madam Chair, our garbage burner in downtown Minneapolis actually does produce electricity. It does, and we're now looking at using the waste heat for either steam or hot water facility as well.
Well, Representative Hart.
Madam Chair, with the growing demand for somewhere to get rid of the refuge, wouldn't it be, with all your knowledge you already have, to develop additional facilities that can burn and produce electricity as well as what you're thinking about here?
Mr. McLaughlin.
Madam Chair, I was not on the county board when the decision was made to site the current garbage burner. My understanding was that the location was the product of an amendment that was introduced on the House floor at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's how it came about. So siting these facilities is not an easy thing. And I would say there has been some discussion. There have been discussions in various places, but frankly, the financing structure for building new waste energy facilities was undercut by the Supreme Court. Now there's been some retreating by the Supreme Court, and there may actually be a new financing mechanism that could produce some additional facilities, but it's a kind of a long haul. We frankly we got burned a little bit by the court decision that took away our ability to control where the waste flowed in order to have a guaranteed stream of revenue. So I don't know that we're going to be getting into that business. There are some commissioners who are interested in that, but that's a long haul.
Representative Earhart? Oh, to that point, Representative Dammey?
Yes, perhaps Representative Earhart would be interested in approaching the county board about having a garbage burner located in his backyard right next to the nuclear plant that's running a whole block of the doctor. It's getting a little crowded back there. Yes, I believe it's by the Peabody.
Representative Earhart. I don't think we're just talking about Hennepin County here. We're talking about the whole state and their county's ability to go into to compete with the private market in any way you want to look at it. And when you say you want to go into this business to reduce property taxes, you could in fact go into other businesses and create profit centers for the counties and use them to reduce taxes, which is exactly what you're doing. You might even have a municipal liquor store. Some cities do.
Now we're talking Edina.
But you can have you can be in other businesses. So why is this one special? We need energy, yeah. But you could run other businesses instead of doing the private sector here.
Madam Chair, that's a fair point. And frankly, the recent Supreme Court decision about that has to do with flow control actually does create some options for counties that didn't exist 3 or 4 years ago before that recent court decision. I mean, it's a power that existed for about 10 years, and then it was taken away by the U.S. Supreme Court, and then it was reinstated on a limited basis. So there are some places people who are looking at those options. A waste energy facility is a multi-million-dollar investment. These things can come in much smaller chunks, frankly, and the risk, I think, is commensurately smaller. So that's one of the reasons to get into this. The other is that there is, I think, the opportunity for a partnership between Greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area to get additional wind energy projects developed and also to help us with our price. That's why we're looking into this. And the waste energy is something that people are looking at, but we've gotten burned once, and it's going to be a tough sell, I think, for a lot of counties right now.
Well, Madam Chair, there are certain areas of the state that are really proficient in producing wind, and is Hennepin County one of those?
Madam Chair, we've actually looked at it. We're kind of on the cusp. We're right on the line, and for the most part, our participation in this has been based on the premise that we would not be producing electricity, we'd be buying it. We'd be buying the electricity that would be produced out in the wind-rich regions of the state. So that, I mean, this is not primarily about our producing it or the other counties in the Metropolitan area producing it with wind energy. It's tapping into the potential that exists, untapped potential that exists in some of the greater Minnesota counties. And that's why they were interested in forming the partnership.
Thank you for that, Representative Zellers.
Madam Chair, I just
want to get to Representative Coon's motion, Representative
Zellers. I think we've exhausted the tax provision, Madam Chair, and I would like to know from Representative Coon where the other section that is passing on is going to. That so for some of us who now have a very keen and piqued interest in this issue can track the rest of the legislation.
Representative Coonan, it would go to the general register, the remaining provisions, but I'm not sure what Representative Coonan's motion is now, if he's reworded Section 2 or deleting Section 2. So, Representative Coonan, you want to tell us? The rest will go to the general register, so I'm sure the rest of the committee. We actually pulled it back to tax to take the tax stuff out.
You can pull it back and keep it,
Madam Chair. After our little discussion up here. We want to leave that language of bonds and certificates in Section 2, so we should go to the original motion that would deal with Section 2 and Section 3.
Okay. Do you want to have Mr. Michael to actually read that oral amendment
it's
for all of us?
Oral amendment, yeah.
But I think we're confused now. You don't want to delete all of Section 2? You want to just take out the issuing bonds and certificates of indebtedness?
No,
the whole thing.
No, we're
holding out.
Yeah,
okay.
We want to leave that language intact.
Okay, so Mr. Michael, if you want to give the committee the oral amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the amendment would be on page 1, delete section 2, and on page 2, delete lines 27 to 35, and on page 3, delete lines 1 to 10. So that would leave what would remain in the bill with the amendment. I guess the amendment before is now superfluous. Yeah. What would remain in the bill is section 1 and section 3, subdivisions 1 and 2. Subdivision 3 has the property tax levy authority in it.
Okay.
And Section 4 was deleted by the earlier amendment.
Okay, so is that clear to everybody? Okay, so that is Representative Coonan's motion. To that motion, further discussion? Okay, if not, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Okay, so that amendment is adopted. Further discussion to the remainder of the bill.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if we've lost what we are. I just wondered if the investor-owned utilities producing electricity have ever testified on this in any place.
Well, I will again repeat, is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against or neutrally or just provide your observations, because they are here, Representative Earhart, and they're certainly able to join us if they'd like. We can't compel them to testify, but did anybody want to testify to this? Nope. Nobody wants to come forward. Okay. Further discussion? Okay. If not, then the remainder of the bill is to remove to move House File 3585 as amended to the general register. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion passes, and House File 3585 is sent to the general register. Thank you, Representative Coonan. Appreciate that. We learned a lot on that one. Thank you. And now we're going to do Representative Keeson's bill. And members, we have about half of the tax committee is the author of this bill. So would any of you like to offer this bill? Representative Broad. Representative Broad moves. Are you on there too, Representative Broad?
I should be Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair. I keep calling you Madam Speaker.
We're on the floor all day. Representative Broad moves House File 3586 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. And what we're going to do is we're going to have, I believe it is Mr. Fields join us at the table. Welcome. And to give us a quick presentation of the bill.
Okay.
And we'll take folks who want to speak to it. And Representative Broad, to get the bill in the order that Representative Thiessen has it, I don't know if Representative Broad has this, it's the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I will move the A1 amendment.
Representative Broad moves the A1 amendment, just pass into the A1 amendment. If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. It's in the order that Representative Thiessen wanted it. And members, I think the committee is very familiar with this. This is the one that authorizes a income tax credit for K-12 for low-income households. So with that, Mr. Fields, welcome, and
thank you.
You get to do this without your author, but we'll help. Welcome.
Yes. And I'm sorry, Representative Thiessen couldn't be here. She had an emergency he needed to take care of. This bill... This is the second year we presented it to this group.
Nice.
This is a bipartisan bill signed by 13 members on this committee that provides an educational opportunity for K-12 poverty kids in Minnesota. That simple. I think you all know that we need to do a better job with our poverty children in Minnesota. We have more black young men in prison than in college. And their road to prison didn't start at the college age. It started when they were not successful in school and grade school. The author asked me to give a little bit of my personal background so you can kind of catch where I come from. So I'll just say this real quickly. And I know 13 people in this committee have already heard this, but I came to Minnesota. In 1970, I was a street worker with the YMCA. I put together the YMCA Detached Worker Program. So I came from Chicago, working with, quote, white street gangs there. One of the first things I learned about Minnesota is that Minnesota is not good at graduating children of color and of poverty. And really have all my life kind of worked on that. I was associate dean at Minneapolis Community College, and for the last 18 years I've been working with private schools, sponsoring diversity workshops, et cetera, et cetera. I found out about this law in Pennsylvania. There's 5 states that have a tax credit for people that donate to a foundation that supports poverty kids in an educational way. Pennsylvania is the only one that includes public school foundation, so we basically copied that law. The amendment, I don't know if I need to go down and explain the amendment changes. It's basically self-written there, I'll field any questions that you like. I have a couple testifiers.
Yes.
First, I'd like to say that the Public School Foundation for Winona is directed by an older man named Jim Hansel. He was scheduled to come here. He was a retired public school teacher. They testified in the Senate hearing. They were not able to come this evening. Also, they're very much in favor of this, of course. And Shonda Smith is on our coalition representing BAIL, the Black Alliance for Educational Options, and she also has a charter school and works for Pillsbury Center, and she was not able to come tonight either, basically taking care of kids. So our first real testifier is Tom McCarver, and I'll let Tom explain himself.
Welcome, Mr. McCarver, and we apologize you had to wait all day as well, so thank you for being with us.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom McCarver. The role that I play in the Catholic school system right now is that of working with 15 inner-city schools. The 15 inner-city schools are 501c3s in themselves, and we are linked with the Archdiocese, which has 110 schools in total. I chose this work with 15 inner-city schools I came to Minnesota in 1982 as a dean at the University of St. Thomas in education and stayed there until 1994, then became the superintendent of Catholic schools for the Archdiocese, and I just retired in 2006. And when I was asked if I could work with basically the poor of the Archdiocese, I jumped at it. My background lends itself well to it. 46% of the 3,000 kids that we serve in these 15 schools known as focus schools, 46% are on free and reduced lunch. And you probably are fully aware that that means that their families earn in the neighborhood of $27,000 or less for a family of four. They are kids who cannot pay for their own lunches. Currently, we have 46%, as I said. That's up from 41% last year. We expect that next year will be somewhere in the low 50s to mid 50s. And we're on a projection to probably hit 60 to 70% of our children in this grouping within 5 years. FOCUS stands for Friends of Catholic Urban Schools. Most of us, I'm the only paid employee of FOCUS. I do all of the grants writing, and I also make the calls asking people for help. Currently, our tuition is listed in these schools as $3,000. $3,000. I have an office at St. Peter Claver School, and three families are able to afford $3,000. Basically, we accept all kids who come, and then we negotiate tuition with them. The actual cost of educating a child, as many people in public schools have probably shared with you, ours is upwards of $5,000, nearing $5,500 right now, $5,500 per child. When we can't have families able to afford tuition, we make up for that by asking for help, financial help. So far, the schools have done that themselves. Risen Christ School, which is part of the coalition, raises $900,000 a year to help with scholarship aid to the students who attend there. And that we have a range of activity and people able to do that. FOCUS came into existence when we started projecting out where we were going to be 4 or 5 years down the road. And we will not be able to make it on the scale that we have been making it up to this point. If FOCUS is not successful in raising additional dollars for these schools, we will have the Catholic schools in the inner city closing within 5 years. That would be my projection. I've been looking at this for 15 years and have been working with them. And I come to strongly support the bill that is here, which would give outsiders a stimulus for making gifts. That's where I see the real value. The gifts could be made by individuals, couples, or by businesses. And you have that in the bill that is written. We need ways to entice those gifts and to have them come forward. Jim is aware that recently we had a foundation come to us and offer us the first very large gift that we're going to be receiving. It's a gift of $20 million. It has not yet been announced, but that will yield $1 million a year to help reduce the cost of tuition for the children that are talked about in this bill. We have to get tuition at an actual level that parents can afford. when I went to school back in the 40s, we were coming out of the Depression, and I can still remember taking my 50 cents to school to pay for a Catholic education. That's no longer the case. So we are faced with accepting all who come, and more who come are kids of color, kids who are poor, and they want to receive a strong education, which we believe in. So I will respond to any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McCarver. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I think there's an error in the revenue note on the back page. It talks about the two times the federal salary for a family of four is $21,200. I think it's $41,000
yeah.
for a family of four at 100%. So that's an error here. And secondly, somehow I think this may be funding of at least indirectly, private schools by the state. Anybody got any suggestions?
I think on the first piece, the eligible student, I think it says it's two times the federal poverty guideline. That's the confusion on that part.
Madam Chair, the amendment.
And what was, Representative Earhart, what was your second?
I think
who are you looking to answer this?
I'm looking for staff, I think.
Ms. Mandy or Mr. Michael or?
Well, whoever has the answer, Madam Chair.
Okay, so what's the question again?
I think that indirectly, if not directly, that this is supplying money to private schools.
Could be.
And I think that's in violation of our Constitution.
Yeah. Well, Representative Earhart, if I may, I'll look to Mr. Michael for a second. I wasn't here for the big Carlson compromise. And if I understand this, this is along that line for an expansion of. And so my guess is it probably isn't unconstitutional if we've kind of got something going right now. But maybe Mr. Michael can, or I don't know if it's Ms. Mandy, someone can kind of tell all of us who weren't here for the Carlson days kind of how that,
yeah.
what's in law, and then what does this, how does this kind of grow that, Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, I think, you know, in answer to your first question, it's fairly obvious that because the you know, the proposed credit rate is very high, that yes, this does have the practical effect of sort of providing, you can characterize it as an incentive or whatever, but it, in effect it does direct money into public government money into these non-public schools.
Mm-hmm.
As to the question about, you know, whether or not this violates the Constitution, that, you know, I have not studied this and haven't been years since I've read those First Amendment cases, and I would be reluctant to hazard an opinion, and it would be worth a, you know, less than a cup of coffee anyway. So,
we can take it.
But it's, you know, there's no question that there's some kind of an issue, and it may very well depend upon the nature of the schools that use this. And, you know, sort of what goes on. There may be other factors that could be involved, but it could be an issue.
Well, Madam Chair.
Yeah,
huh.
And quite honestly, from what I understand, the law in this area is very gray and is in something of a flux. You know, there's litigation over vouchers in other states and so forth.
Well, Madam Chair, I didn't hear anything but Catholic when we were hearing the presentation. And that's fine, but that's a church school, and I think there is a separation here, which we won't pursue because Mr. Michaels is shaking his head there.
Well, in Western Art, I think the bill applies to a lot more than religious schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand that, Madam Chair, but it also includes religious
yes.
schools.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Michael, before we hear from Representative Yarrows and Coles, what is the Arne Carlson big compromise? What happened there? I mean, we currently have a K-12 credit that you can use in private schools right now, I believe.
It's a deduction,
but I think it's helpful. Can you tell us what the current deduction is in the K-12 private school credit situation already.
Oh,
Ms. Manzi or whoever.
There's both a deduction and a credit.
Yeah. Okay.
And essentially, the deduction is only allowable. Let me phrase it. The tuition is allowed only under the deduction, whereas other costs, like everything from school supplies to tutoring and those kinds of things, are allowed under both the credit, which is a 75% credit, if I recall correctly now, and under the subtraction or deduction. And obviously the tax benefit is much larger under the credit, and that's restricted to lower income families. I think the cap is at about $35,000, but varies based on the number of dependents.
And following Representative Earhart's question, is are the courts more, you know, okay with the deductions as opposed to the credits? Are the credits sort of, I think what he's getting at is the credits are sort of more egregious, I guess, from the constitutional question, or is that not the case?
Madam Chair, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld our deduction in the 1980s. The Minnesota court struck down in the early 70s of a different credit that the state had, and the U.S. Supreme Court struck down an analogous credit that another state had, but those are different than the credit that we have now. Because the credit provides a much larger benefit and essentially redirect more public resources to these schools, the level of scrutiny seems likely to be higher than it would be with the deduction, which we know, because the Supreme Court has blessed it, is constitutional. Our deduction is.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
Representative Earhart,
were the Minnesota law ever tested
on the credit portion, or the deduction?
Well, either one of them.
Michael?
They were.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Minnesota deduction. To my knowledge, the current credit that we have not been tested.
Okay, so Representative Yarrow.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to, I think that's what I remember. Also, this is what I was going to say.
You know, well, Representative Yarrow, I mean, my understanding of this was that there was a big battle over vouchers, and that's why I'm looking to the people who were here, and sort of the final compromise was Governor Carlson didn't get vouchers, but he got the deduction for tuition, and the credit didn't happen.
Credit.
Ms. Manzi.
Credit.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the K-12 education deduction for tuition predated Governor Carlson's tenure.
Okay.
It went back into the 1960s or 50s, so it went way back as the deduction. The U.S. Supreme Court test of it, I believe, was in the 1980s, at which time it was upheld. In Governor Carlson's administration, the bill that was enacted added the K-12 education credit at the time at 100%, and it expanded the list of items that were that applied for the deduction. The credit that was enacted applied to everything that was allowed under the deduction except for tuition for non-public schools. So prior to whatever year that was in Governor Carlson's administration, the deduction was limited to generally textbooks, transportation, and tuition. And textbooks was defined to include equipment and supplies. It was expanded to include tutoring, to include a limited amount of purchases of computer hardware and software, to include academic summer camps and extracurricular programs, and that's all that's coming to mind at the moment. But so the deduction was expanded and the credit was added at 100% only for low-income families and for everything the deduction went for except for the tuition.
Thank you for that. Okay, Representative Lash.
Well, thank you. My question is the change that could make the current law. Currently, the corporation gives to your school, or a public school, I believe, it should be the same. But under this change, if a corporation decides to make a donation to a public school or a private school, would it still be the same or would it be different?
Mr. McGarvey, or...
Could I answer that?
Yeah.
The tax credit and deduction that the discussion has been around is the individual tax payer. If they spend that money on education way, then they get a deduction or a credit from their taxes. What this bill is about is a tax credit for somebody to give to a foundation. The foundation, of course, when the person gives the money, they release control of that money. That money is from the foundation. Has to spend that money on poverty children, either a poverty school that has 40% poverty, or a poverty child that meets these requirements. Okay. So a public school would use it for, and I have two daughters that teach in public schools. They'll come home and talk about, they'll have a child in their math class, if they could just give them a quick tutor for 4 weeks, the child could catch up and be able to do that. This would pay for that. That's something that the Public School Foundation could use it for. I talked with the director of Minneapolis Achieve, which is the Minneapolis School Foundation. She said, well, I would use this to, we have this program to work with poverty children in the Minneapolis schools to get them to college. They can't afford the ASCT test. They can't afford the tutor to help that with that, and we need more counselors. And that's they started that program. They're working with the Minneapolis Chamber that's raising money for them, and that's how she would use that money. So give you some examples.
Okay, Representative West.
Okay, I think I heard you say they would still be treated the same. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, so Representative West.
Thank
you. Okay, Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief given the hour. thank you, Representative West, for raising that, because I think the discussion was focusing on individuals and the tuition tax credit itself is a little bit different, although maybe analogous. I guess my question is for Mr. McGarvey?
McCarver. McCarver.
Thank you, I apologize. Thank you. Mr. McCarver, as a parent with two children in Catholic schools, I know for a fact that we're not paying 50 cents for tuition any longer. I guess the question I have for the focus schools that you work with, do they have the capacity to take on additional kids, or would they find the capacity to take on additional kids if the resources were there to provide that? And I guess one of the things, the only concern, I'm a co-author on the bill, I support the bill, the only concern I would have is, are we providing any kind of disincentive for, in your case, for the Archdiocese to not work quite as hard to find other donors, other contributors, and to just rely on some kind of state tax credit that we're creating, or for any other organization that might benefit under this proposal?
Mr. McCarver.
We have, in terms of the space available in these 15 schools, we have about 45% of the space currently used. So we would have room for another 55% of space. That would come out to around 3,000 kids, another 3,000 kids. We've been getting a surge of kids who are not Catholic coming into our schools, and a surge of kids who are coming from public schools where there is dissatisfaction. And we accept all of the children. There has been a myth out there, I think, for a long time, that Catholic schools accept only Catholics. That never has been true. And it is much less true now. I have an office at St. Peter Claver, which is located at 94 and Lexington. It's the traditional Black American school for the Archdiocese. We have 155 kids. 153 are African American right now. And we need to build some more space soon because we're filling those classrooms. So we are looking at that in a couple of our places like that. But we have a range of non-Catholic kids in our schools, probably starting with about 20% up to 95% at St. Peter Claver.
That's some calls.
Thank you, Matt.
Okay, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, and I apologize to whoever claimed authorship of the bill and for the... That's sorry, that was out of the room, but I think my question is to Mr. McCarver. And I'm aware from past years that the Archdiocese over the last 20 years has seen significant declining enrollment, and you just testified that you've got significant vacant space in your buildings. I was on the east side of St. Paul just Saturday night, and we went by the United School of St. John's and some of these things. You're nodding. Can you help me with
Trinity?
St. Francis, John James, yeah. I just United School, and it was clear, you know, the Archdiocese has been seeing declining enrollment and has been merging schools, closing schools. There's been some real tumult, I know, in the system over which schools got closed, and I think you held back on closing one of the high schools because there was enough agitation in the last year or two.
In the last 20 years, two schools have closed.
Okay. I guess my question to the Archdiocese, when I think about families at 200% of poverty, who is what you're targeting here, and I'm a K-12 person, so I believe passionately in the importance of education. But as a tax committee person as well, how do I prioritize the education needs of those students over 200% of poverty? There's probably significant mobility in terms of housing. And why not a K-12 credit for donations to a foundation for housing? I think about medical care, and Representative Friesen is an expert, but will probably be the first to acknowledge that a lot of people who qualify for state-subsidized health care programs don't actually get into them. So how do we prioritize education over health care for these children? I think about what's going on with energy costs, and there was an article in the Pioneer Press on Saturday or Sunday about kind of a loophole that the utilities have found in the what do we call the program that prevents them from shutting people off in the winter? They found a loophole and they're shutting people off. These are probably families who would benefit from donations to a foundation to help them afford energy costs. I think about what's going on with food costs, and at 200% of poverty, you're probably visiting food shelves to be able to make
food
things happen.
Available.
But how do we decide that we should prioritize donations to K-12 for education over housing, health care, food, the other basic needs of these families?
Madam Chair, before I get to the last part of your question, first part I want to tackle. I was the superintendent of schools from 1994 until 2006. During that period of time, our enrollments have been increasing. They reached 37,000 two years ago, and we've gone down about 1,000 kids throughout the system over the last 2 years. But we're now larger than Minneapolis Public Schools in our archdiocese. And it looks as though throughout most of the system, and my reason for coming to the 15 schools, most of the schools are doing quite well right now. The inner city schools are not doing as well, and that's where the vacancies are starting to occur in there. On the question of priorities, I think I would agree with you on everything that you said. We are working with the poor. You are working with the poor. And TOR does not stop with our taking care of their education. We are concerned about their food. That's why we're taking care of free and reduced lunches. That's why we have food shelves in our surrounding parishes to help those families as well. And anything that you could do to assist this particular group of people would be helpful. The numbers are increasing, and we're seeing that happen almost overnight in our place. And I think the projections are going to start to pick up, especially now that it's hard to get work for many of the people in our areas. So I don't know how you're going to work that out. My concern is their education. And I know darn well that if these kids do not receive a very sound education, and I oversee the K-8 portion of this system, and I'm also concerned about the 9 to 12 as well. We just built another new school in the area, the Cristo Rey School, which is located down at Lake Street and 2nd Avenue. And the qualifications to get in is that kids' families may not earn more than $32,000. We want to assure that we're working with the poorest in the neighborhoods down in the Phillips area. So our concern is education. And when I saw the bill come along, I looked at the Pennsylvania bill as well. That has already run the test. I don't know of the exact number of years that they've had that operative. 5 years, they've been in existence 5 years. There's already been a test of that program. And the best we can do that I can help with is education. But I really thank you for getting those other issues out there. I'm in agreement with you.
Representative
and Ms. McCarver, I would imagine our hearts are very much the same place. But you do realize that if we were to pass this credit into law at a time when we've got a $935 million deficit and are looking forward to the next biennium, a $1.2 or more billion deficit, this tax credit takes money away from our being able to provide assistance to poor families for housing, for food, for health care, and anything else we care about.
I think you're speaking to your friend.
Okay, Representative West. And we still are going to get to Representative Thielen's bill tonight. Representative West.
And I'm sure when I asked my question before, I didn't realize you guys were representing the archdiocese because I came in late. Is that, both have offices of the archdiocese? Is that true?
I do not.
However, I'm a 501c3 separately incorporated from the Archdiocese with a group called Focus.
Focus.
Okay. Friends of Catholic Urban Schools.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my question, but it's for the Catholic Schools of the Archdiocese, is that true? Okay. And thank you, Madam Chair. My question then is this. You mentioned the struggle that the urban Catholic schools are having. I don't know how many years ago it was, but with my church, I was involved in a campaign called Growing in Faith Campaign. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many thousands of dollars I paid in. I think it was $2,000. And I went around asking for money from all the other parishioners, too, that put in the same amount for this Growing in Faith Campaign, capital fundraising for the Archdiocese. And a certain percentage, I think it was about $30 million, 10% or ballpark, went to renovate it. Cathedral, which looks really nice and what they did, but the lion's share, the majority of that money, went to support a foundation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, to guarantee loans for a Catholic school, renovation or building, what have you. And they raised money all throughout the Archdiocese, but what that went to support was the building of new schools in the suburbs, in areas of high income, high tax base. And they turned around and threatened to close the schools in my neighborhood, which includes St. Bernard's up on Wright Street, St. Agnes. And I couldn't figure out why I was given all this money to the Archdiocese to support Catholic schools, and they're turning around closing the schools in my neighborhood. How in the heck do we know that this is in any way going to benefit that, and I understand that there's the means tested in the bill, come, but I don't have any great faith in the archdiocese after that effort. Maybe even say it's not my job to answer that, but...
Madam Chair, Mr. McCann, I'm going to risk a lot in saying some of these things. There have been two capital campaigns. The one that you referred to was done when Harry Flynn came in as Archbishop. Prior to that, John Roach had one. What that produced was a sum of money that is now invested in the foundation, the Catholic Community Foundation. And it yields $3 million a year, which is going to support St. Bernard's. St. Bernard's gets $164,000 a year. St. Agnes gets about the same amount. And Risen Christ receives $475,000 a year. The money is dispersed throughout the archdiocese to very small schools out in the suburbs, and the inner city schools that are here. I think there are 30 that are benefiting from that. So I appreciate your helping with that campaign. All of that money was sunk into that. And the other fund that created another way of helping the archdiocese with loans, that was true. $50 million of one of the campaigns went into that, and that is still being done. Standing up new schools, I was partially responsible for some of that. We had a need for schools out in the surrounding areas. One high school that was out in the southwest corner, and two of the elementary schools, which were directly west. But now the Archdiocese is as concerned, it's always been concerned about the poor. And we're trying to help those schools make it through right now.
Madam Chair, can
I explain? I think we're done. We want to finish the show up. Is there anyone else that has a question? Mr. Fields?
Oh, I just one thing. The bill requires the foundation to report on the poverty kids that were served.
Okay. And Mr. McGarver, Representative West is a good Catholic, as you can see, by how hard he worked to raise money for those schools.
Thank you.
You got
it.
Okay.
You,
anyone else in the public? If not, we're going to lay over this bill on Representative. I apologize. Yes, welcome. Please join us. Sure, we'd love to hear your testimony. I didn't realize there was someone else. And then we're going to get to Representative Kalen's bill. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, I know it's late, and my Senate testimony was not over 2 minutes, as I recall, and I will keep it perhaps even less. I am representing Education Minnesota. I'm also a contributing member of St. Patrick's Catholic Church on the east side, a former altar boy. I could go on. But we, as an organization, oppose tax credits that direct public funds to private schools. It is important to note that this bill does not allow corporations to give money, donate money to private schools. This allows money that would otherwise go into the general fund, 40% of which already goes to K-12 funding. So it's it conceivably results in a 100% redirection to private schools. So it takes money away from K-12, and that has been pointed out. But we would also want to make one extra point, and that is that earlier this session, the legislature passed a bill that eliminated the federal income tax deduction conformity state income tax provision for teacher school supplies. That was a tax deduction of up to $250. This is a $10,000 tax credit for individuals, $100,000 for corporations. In the same session that teachers lost a $250
tax deduction for classroom supplies, we don't think it makes sense for this bill to be considered. The reason given for that loss of that tax deduction was that the cost of it, which is $1 million, and this bill would cost $10 million. It doesn't make sense. There are many provisions in this bill that, you know, I could go through, but in the interest of time, I won't. But there are so many things that are just not required of private schools that public schools have to comply with, such as admitting special ed students and providing ELL education. So there's a long list of that. I won't go through it in the interest of time.
Can we get your name for the
Renee Lara, Education Minnesota.
Okay. How do you spell it? Lara?
L-A-R-A.
Okay. Thank you for that. Other questions for Mr. Lara? We appreciate your patience. I apologize. I didn't recognize you were there. Further public testimony on this bill? If not, we're going to lay over Representative Stephen Bill that's been moved by Representative Broad for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And thank you all for being here. And Representative Kalin has a bill still, and he requested to go last. So here he is, last. And I will move, I don't have the number, House File.
I believe, Madam Chair, 3939.
I'll move House File 3939 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good evening, and hopefully in a few minutes we can say good night. House File 3939 is an attempt to revitalize and boost our economy, building on an existing tax credit. I brought along testifiers in print rather than in person, figuring it might be a more flexible way to present the case.
Is that Governor Pawlenty there that's testifying?
It is indeed.
For your
I
bill?
Believe
okay.
that we have not used any hockey metaphors nor anything else, so we should be okay with Governor Pawlenty right now. Madam Chair and members, you might remember that Minnesota we've adopted with the support of the legislature and with the signature of the governor in the last several years, some of the nation's leading environmental policies, including the Renewable Energy Standard, an Energy Conservation and Efficiency Bill that I authored, our greenhouse gas emission reduction, the Clean Water Legacy initiative that Representative Osment shepherded through the House a couple of years ago before my time, and then, of course, our biofuels standard, our biofuels goal. Those are listed lines 2.16 to 2.27. Well, Madam Chair and members, one of the things that that I've noticed has been to conferences and engaging with other leaders from around the country is that other states are benefiting from our work. Iowa, for instance, drew four of the world's largest wind turbine manufacturers to build plants in Iowa, to grow jobs in Iowa, to grow their economy in Iowa, by holding up a map showing Iowa in the south and Minnesota in the north and saying, look, they have this new 25 by 25 renewable energy standard. They need to get the turbines from somewhere. We're going to build them here in Iowa. Wisconsin just got a national renewable energy lab. All across the board, we're seeing that other states are beating Minnesota the punch. And one of the hurdles is that, let me back up, actually, Madam Chair. When Representative Peterson, Aaron Peterson and I, sniffed out that Vestas, the world's largest wind turbine manufacturer, a Danish company, was looking at building a research and development center in the United States, we made an effort to attract their attention, which we did. We did not make the short list, and I believe we didn't make the short list not because Minnesota doesn't deserve to be on the short list of five states, but because of the needed concentration to draw green economy and green job businesses to Minnesota. One of the things that we heard from Vestas, in addition to needing talent, in this case engineers, a high quality of life, both of which I think we have, the third thing that they really wanted were incentives. And looking at our existing research and development credit, saying that we already have these strong environmental policies, I believe all of which, certainly four of the five, passed the legislature with more than 90% of the vote, that we should make a concentrated effort to be a player in the fastest growing part of our economy in the next 5 to 10 years. And I believe the research and development credit is how to do that, to generate ideas like we did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s with the Minnesota Miracle and Honeywell and Control Data, 3M, et cetera. I believe from there the bill is pretty self-explanatory. I know that there may be some questions. I would like to offer one change to make it consistent with some language that's in the budget bill dealing with green jobs, and that is on line 2.9, 2.10, 2.12, 2.28, and 29, replacing the term environmental, or the word environmental with the term green economy. So, Madam Chair, on line 2.9, that would, for instance, read 10% of the green economy research expenditures.
Okay, so I will move the oral amendment to replace wherever we see the word environmental with the word green economy on line 2.9, 2.10. Where else was it, Representative Kalin?
Madam Chair,
2.12.
And then again, you caught it correctly, 2.28 and 2.29.
2.28 and 2.29. Discuss into the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Okay, so questions for Representative Kalin? Or are there testifiers or anyone for or against who would like to discuss this bill with us? Okay, well, members, questions for Representative Kalin. Representative Kalin, you weren't able to be here earlier, and we talked about the fact that this committee has a lot of folks doing a lot of similar things,
mm-hmm.
and we're trying to encourage all these legislators who are interested in these sort of credits to try to get together and think through maybe a surgical approach to combine kind of and reduce the cost of all these proposals that are before us. And they are bipartisan. Folks on both sides of the aisle have them. Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, I just, your testimony is a conclusion. I'd like you to confirm it. That you recognize that when businesses are making decisions about where they're going to either site or expand their operations, the tax and regulatory environment in a particular change is relevant to that consideration. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Representative Kalin.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, I know that intimately because 17 of the 21 businesses in the Osceola, Wisconsin industrial park across the river from my district were Minnesota, were Chisago County businesses a decade ago. You better believe that the bottom line is important as you're making these business decisions.
Agreement. Okay, is there anything else? If not, we're going to lay over reps on Kalin's bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax. So thanks for waiting so long, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.